This is David Harvey, and you're listening to the Anti-Capitalist Chronicles, a podcast that looks at capitalism through a Marxist lens. This podcast is made possible by Democracy at Work. One of my favorite novels is Love in the Time of Cholera by Marquez. And it's rather much in that line that I want to talk today about anti-capitalist politics in the time of COVID-19, which is the coronavirus, which is traveling around the world. I think it's important maybe also to record the date of this talk because it's on March the 9th, 2020. And when I left home this morning, the stock market had declined in very short order by more than 7%. And the stock market has a trigger which stops trading when it seems that there is a panic underway. And today, the trigger was triggered. And so there was a pause. And right now, over the last couple of weeks, the stock market has probably lost around 15% of its value, which is still nowhere near what it lost in 2007, 2008, which was around, I don't know, 40 or 50% of its value. But still, it's very significant. So clearly, something is afoot. Something is taking place which is not good from the standpoint of capital, but maybe provides some opportunities for anti-capitalist politics from another standpoint. So let's begin perhaps by reflecting a little bit on the nature of this virus and where it comes from. There is a tendency to regard these events as due to nature and that therefore something outside of human intervention, human human comprehension. That, however, is fundamentally an erroneous way to look at it. Marx would argue that the metabolic relation to nature is a very complex interweaving flow of influences and transformations. And the result is that there is very little that occurs which is, quote, natural, that does not have intertwined with it some aspect of human action, some aspect of human utilization. And so it is with these viruses. Many of these viruses arise out of agricultural practices or food consumption practices. And the practices which are most caught up in this are high density, very intense food and animal rearing activities. Now, I don't know and have no privileged understanding of where this particular virus came from, but the whole line of coronaviruses, which has been known from the 1960s onwards and produced events like SARS and so on, this whole line is about mutations which occur and in the viral structures. And these mutations, in order to grab hold, need to have an adequate host environment. In other words, mutations are occurring all of the time, but it's only under certain circumstances that the mutations grab hold and become kind of viral problems for the whole human system of production and reproduction. In this instance, what we've seen, for instance, in southern China, animal rearing practices and food production practices and marketing practices, which provide host constructions so that particular viral mutations can take place. So it is, I think, no accident that this came out of southern China, where we know these sorts of practices exist. Once there, then the structure of human populations becomes very significant. Generally speaking, viral transformations need a certain density of human populations. I recall, for example, in my undergraduate days, learning about measles transmission.
and the fact that measles, by and large, didn't infect small villages and rural areas. It mainly needed fairly large towns in order for measles to become an epidemic. So human action creates environmental conditions in which mutations can actually lead into something of the sort that we've seen with the sudden emergence of this coronavirus, the COVID-19. And then, of course, the problem is how far does it spread and what are the mechanisms of its transmission? And on that, of course, we immediately see that the world is not an isolated place, and there are not isolated places within it, and there is a lot of travel going on, and that therefore what we find in our own era of quote globalization is the relative ease with which various forms of mutation of this kind can get transmitted. We saw this in HIV/AIDS. We saw it in SARS. We saw it in bird flu. We've seen it in all of these areas. That the problem is that since there is a lot of travel going on and a lot of motion, a lot of movement in the world, it is relatively easy for these viral infections to move from one place to another. So it was to be expected when the viral transformation was first identified in China, that there would likely be a spillover into the rest of the world. But on this point, the Chinese clamped down very, very fast. This was a very different, I think, response than there was in the SARS epidemic, when it seems that the Chinese engaged in a lot of denial until the SARS epidemic was well underway, in which case one could be critical of the Chinese for not acting fast enough. There was probably some of that in the present corona infection, but the Chinese actually fessed up pretty quickly to what was going on and acted pretty quickly. And I know that Xi Jinping basically said anybody concealing information or distorting information would be severely dealt with fairly early on. And so the Chinese actually blocked a lot of the transmission by basically putting a quarantine over a million or more people in Wuhan province. By doing that, the Chinese actually bought time. And when the event was first mentioned, it was immediately recognized, I think, in certain circles that this could pose a possible threat. So the day that this information came out and became global, there was a decline in the stock market, a sudden drop in the stock market. But then something peculiar happened in that people looked at the situation and said, well, maybe this is just a repeat of the SARS event. And the SARS event was relatively easily contained and had very few deaths and therefore had a very minimal effect. So I think probably people suddenly said, oh, well, this is just like SARS. Don't bother about it. And the stock market went up. It went up higher and higher and higher until about 10 days ago, when it was suddenly realized this was not a SARS event. This was going way beyond it. There had been an immediate sort of a diffusion of the virus. It got into South Korea, and there was an epicenter of development there. And then, surprise, surprise, suddenly it was in northern Italy. Now, when it got into northern Italy, and you can say, well, either this changes the consciousness of what this is all about because it's northern Italy and not some Asiatic country. But when it got into northern Italy, suddenly everybody ran a mile. And within a few weeks, of course, what we've seen in northern Italy is the closure and of the whole of the economy of northern Italy. And that clearly is very significant, not only for Italy, but for Europe, but also for global capitalism. So the spread and the diffusion of this epidemic is something which we need to look at, and there is an attempt to engage in containment practices. And like I say, the Chinese bought us about maybe a month where we could have prepared for perhaps, but nothing very much was done, and everybody assumed it would just go away. Plainly, it's not going away. And now we have a serious collapse going on in global stock markets, which have also been affected by an argument between Saudi Arabia and Russia over oil, and the crash of oil prices on top of this epidemic is actually creating mayhem in the global economy. But I then want to think about this and say, well, to what degree is COVID-19 an anti-capitalist agent? And to what degree does this epidemic create the opportunity for radical transformation of how capital is working, and in what ways will it cause that? So in what sense and why will an epidemic of this kind actually affect the global economy? Well, I tend to work in my own mind with this sort of map of the flow of capital. And there are various points where things can happen which are actually threaten the continuity of capital accumulation and the continuity of capital accumulation circulation. And in this case, the main threat arises at the point of what we call realization of value. It's not immediately affecting the production of value, though, of course, as the realization goes sticky, so the production starts to go sticky. But the problem is the realization of value. And this means that there's a consumption problem. And there are two forms of consumption, as Marx has constantly reminded us. One is productive consumption, which is the consumption of the capitalist producers of goods and services in the creation, so that an automobile, in order to be made, well, somebody has to make the tires and somebody makes the component parts and so on, and then they're assembled in the automobile. So productive consumption is about the consumption of partially finished products within the production process. And so that's the first place where we might find a blockage. The other point of blockage might be in final consumption. But let's look first at productive consumption. What we're dealing with here is the value chains which are involved in contemporary productive activity. An Apple computer is drawing upon complex value chains of different companies in different parts of the world, producing parts which are then assembled into the Apple computer and then before it is sold. Now, those places where this can happen can be affected by the virus, in the sense that the workforce may find itself unable to function because suddenly a large proportion of the workforce is struck down by the fever. And because of the contaminant effect, many of the firms which are involved will need to shut down, to furlough their workers, to get them off site because of the intensity of the epidemic effect. So what this does is to create a blockage so that the parts which are needed, the key parts that are needed for, say, an Apple computer or an automobile or whatever, suddenly are lacking. Because mostly in under contemporary conditions of globalization and just-in-time production systems and all the rest of it, there are not large inventories around of the parts. The tendency is to kind of say, well, each week a certain flow of parts comes in, but suddenly that flow doesn't materialize because the factories had to shut down because of the epidemic. And so then that means that the Apple computer cannot be assembled because the key part is missing. So this is one area where there can be a serious blockage to the dynamics of capital accumulation and capital circulation. Now, where that blockage occurs depends very much. If there are a variety of epicenters, right now where the COVID-19 is most troublesome is, of course, in the central area of China, not even the whole of China, but the central area of China in Wuhan province. So if you have a supplier of key parts that is operating in Wuhan province, you're not going to find very much coming out of there. The other area is South Korea. There's quite a concentration of cases in South Korea. And of course, now in northern Italy, where the whole of Lombardy has been, in effect, put under isolated and quarantined. So there are now, there may be other areas where there are problems of this kind, but if you're drawing your raw materials from, say, Brazil or Mexico or something like that, there maybe is not much of a problem right now because the parts will be fully working. So what this would mean is that there are certain sectors of the economy which may be affected in this way. There are certain firms within those sectors which may be affected in this way. And those firms will find themselves in economic difficulty because for a period of time, they will not be able to produce because of shortages of key parts, because they're drawing those parts from these key areas. Now, one of the things that will likely happen, and we're beginning to see this happening in Wuhan province, once the virus has gone through the population, and we now know that about 80% of the population which gets it is going to be okay probably within 2-3 weeks, maybe a month. And the population as a whole will likely find that the severity of the epidemic will gradually sort of erode away so that after, say, 4 months or something of this kind, then there will be no new cases. The epidemic will have gone through the population. People will have survived the epidemic. The 80% will have survived okay. Another 15 or so percent will sort of be more troubled. But we'll be back to work within a month. And then, of course, we know that right now that the death rate from the virus is something like maybe somewhere between 2 and 3%. But by and large, that is targeting elderly population and populations with underlying conditions, which often means that there are people who are not actively participating in the workforce anyway. So you would expect that in Wuhan itself, things would get back to normal probably in 3 or 4 months or something of that kind. And since it started in February or January, we would expect that maybe by midsummer at the latest, Wuhan will come back online and we'll be able to produce the goods. And in some instances, we'll be able to do it earlier, but we'll be able to produce the goods which get back into the value chain. And so everything will recover. So what we're talking about here is an interruption of capital accumulation, a loss of productive capacity over a period of maybe 3 or 4 months of that kind. And clearly, this is going to affect profitability. In some instances, if the company was on the edge of economic difficulty, the company may go under because it cannot withstand the shock. In these instances, governments may step in to sort of make sure the company can recover. Banks may step in to roll over the debt and so on. So we would see a hit on the growth syndrome. And that hit on the growth syndrome will probably knock one or two, maybe one percentage point off a GDP. So it's a serious hit. But in the long run, it will be a blip, as it were, on the long-run accumulation process. So this would be one way to think about this. Now, as the virus spreads, if it gets into other productive economies, say it gets into Germany, let's suppose it really gets into Japan in a big way, and there's some hints of it developing in Japan, let's suppose it gets into Brazil, let's suppose it gets into other... So we may have a rolling kind of problem that the Wuhan problem will be repeated elsewhere, as we were beginning to see it being repeated in northern Italy. We may see it be repeated in different parts of the world. We don't know that, whether that will happen or not. There may be the successful containment of the problem in various places, and so places may insulate themselves from this in certain ways. So we don't know what the total effect is likely to be. But the main point I think we would make is that whatever the main effect is, we wouldn't expect it to actually be a serious problem in the global economy for more than a year or at most 18 months, depending upon the containment and the diffusion of the thing. But in fact, there may be, as there was with the SARS epidemic, a fairly quick containment from this point on. And if there is strict containment of it from this point on, then the effect in the long run will be relatively short, because what will happen is that the companies that have been deprived of inputs will be able to resume work, and probably will find, depending upon what it is being produced, that there's a pent-up demand which has not been satisfied because, you know, Apple has closed down or the computer companies have closed down. But then they will recover very rapidly, and there will be a sort of a surge of activity. Now, this is how the thing looks from the standpoint of productive consumption. And we see that there's a problem of consumption. That consumption problem carries over to actually restrain production. So the consumption problem gets parlayed into a production problem, so that something like Apple computers, for example, or Apple iPhones and so on cannot be produced. During that period, people may be laid off, workers may be furloughed, they may or may not receive any remuneration. In fact, probably they won't receive remuneration. So there will be an effect of all of this on final consumption. So that brings us to the question of how do we start to think about the final consumption side of things? And this is, it seems to me, the place where the big impacts likely to be, and could be long-lasting impacts. And this is therefore something that is far more serious, in my view, than the productive consumption aspect. The final consumption aspect is simply that consumption is going to be affected by the reaction of populations to the threat which the virus poses to human well-being and to human life. This threat is quite substantial by one measure, which is, even though the death rate from it, of this virus, is only maybe 2.5%. We're not sure of that, by the way. There have been some figures coming out recently that suggest it's as high as 4%, in which case it is far, far higher than an ordinary flu epidemic, where there is a death rate associated with that, but I think it's of the order of 0.1 or 0.2%. But we're now talking about 2% or 3%, which is, when you're taking 2 or 3% of millions and billions of people, that's a very large number of premature deaths. Now, the fear of the virus is going to lead to certain adjustments immediately of trying to prevent the spread of the virus. Now, what we've seen in Wuhan is a complete shutdown containment, quarantine of the whole population. And we're now seeing a repeat performance of that in northern Italy. But there are certain forms of consumption which are heavily affected by this, by the virus. And here we get back into some of the aspects of contemporary capitalism and what contemporary capitalism is about. I've argued in a former discussion I've argued that the form of consumption these days is very much around instantaneous consumer activities and instantaneous consumption forms, which are built around the idea that mass consumption has to be so accelerated to accommodate the exponential growth of capital accumulation and capital circulation. That is, the acceleration and growth of capital and its exponential growth requires rapid increase in consumer markets. And these consumer markets are set up in such a way that they do not last very long. And the sorts of examples I would use would be, well, think of a Netflix series where, okay, a lot of value is created in the making of the series, but then it is marketed, it can be simultaneously marketed to millions of people, and just for 1 hour. And then it's gone, unless people want to watch it again, in which case it has a sort of long tail of being marketed. So this is a certain economy where once you've had the experience, it's gone. Now, one of the areas where we find this form of economy has increased dramatically has been not only in things like Netflix with their particular mode of monetization, which means that you don't actually necessarily have to buy things. You just subscribe to the channel, and it's through subscriptions that the thing gets monetized. But another way of doing this has been through the rise of what might be called spectacular events and cultural events and experiential forms of consumption, one of the leading forms of which is tourism. Now, since the 1970s, what we've seen is an immense growth in what might be called spectacular kinds of consumerism. I remember, for example, when I first went to Baltimore in 1969, there were about three museums around. As the blue-collar economy, the steelworks and auto works and all the rest of it collapsed, so the city started to look for new ways of economic development. And one of the new ways was cultural industries. So cultural industries suddenly came along so you start to build new museums and all this kind of stuff, and you start to kind of say, come to Baltimore for the tourist industry because we have all of these museums around, and the same in New York and Paris and London and all the rest of it start to kind of market themselves. So cultural industries offer an experience. And cultural industries became a big form of urban development, and people go there for the experience. And once you have the experience is over and it's gone, and you go on to the next experience. So the experiential kind of form of economic activity starts to become significant. And as I've suggested, there's been a huge increase in those forms of consumerism, and along with that, a huge increase in tourism. Now, tourism is interesting in this way too, that people actually consume the experience. And of course, they're attracted by the experience, and you look at all of the ads to go and sort of sit on the beaches of the Caribbean or you know, the Mediterranean or wherever. So tourism is very much that. But one of the things that's happened is that capital has flown into not only cultural industries and the production of the sort of Netflix economy type stuff, but it's also flowed into international tourism. Just to give you a measure of this, over the last 10 years, the number of foreign visits, tourist visits, according to the International Tourist Association, has risen globally from 800 million to 1.4 billion. That is, over 10 years, it's increased by 600 million journeys. Now, so this is a real mass increase in the tourist industry. And this has implications for the kinds of consumerism upon which contemporary capitalism rests. Now, I can't tell you exactly what proportion of the GDP of countries is taken up by tourist activities, and I can't tell you exactly, but I know that it's big, and I know it's been growing bigger by the minute over the last 20 years in particular. Because, like I say, that is the form of consumerism that it can instantaneously be overcome. It can also be collectively enjoyed, so that we start to look at the way in which sports events, cultural everything coming together. Now, the big question is, to what degree are those events impeded by the existence and the threat of contamination by COVID-19? In other words, if this form of consumption and consumerism is going to be viable, it's very difficult to see it being viable when everybody is fearful of contact with other human beings because they may get this disease. And now this may lead to long-standing and large-scale reconfigurations of daily life. And insofar as that happens, this is going to, I think, have a very big impact upon how global capitalism is working. And just to give you one, I think, very important example, tourism, it nearly always involves package tours. Those package tours are not only about the place you go to, but they nearly always contain one element, which is the flying, the airfare. Now, if the north of Italy is closed down and you can't go in and you can't go to Milan and you can't go to Venice, then there's no flights going to go there either. And right now, a lot of the flights from Europe to northern Italy have been cancelled. That is a huge impact, has a huge impact upon the airlines. Now, in fact, airlines are getting into real difficulty right now because nobody wants to fly. You know, being cooped up in an airplane is not a very safe environment from the standpoint of the transmission of something like COVID-19. So the airlines are beginning to have a lot of difficulty. And on top of that, by the way, there is, I think, one fantastic positive thing, which is to the degree that airline flights are being curbed, and we've seen them being curbed all over Europe and increasingly inside the United States. So actually, greenhouse gas emissions are declining. So we may actually do far more for the climate change politics. And in this sense, we can say that COVID-19 is a good anti-capitalist antidote to the way in which the environment and climate change is being provoked via the new forms of consumerism. So this is one of the kind of sidebars. So this area of impact and what that might mean is something that we need to look at very, very closely. And so what I want to do in the next session is to talk very much about the transformation of daily life, which is, and here we may find some very long-term consequences for the dynamics of capital accumulation. And that will also help to explain why it is the stock market took such a plunge right now and seems destined to plunge even further in the weeks to come.
Thank you for joining me today. You've been listening to David Harvey's Anti-Capitalist Chronicles, a Democracy at Work production. A special thank you to the wonderful Patreon community for supporting this project.